All right, this is episode 4 of Eerie Listener. I'm Jay Stevens.
And I'm John Linvey.
And we got a pretty good show tonight. Greg Gagne of the Seawolves, the voice of the Seawolves. We'll be talking with him in a little ball. Pretty good. I told him, it's a little embarrassing, but this is the interview that I imagined doing when we first started the podcast.
Yeah, I could tell you were excited. I could tell that you were definitely excited to talk to him because you're a baseball guy.
Yeah, I'm a fanboy. I'm like, you know, like I love.
You just want to talk stats. That's all you want to do.
That's all I want to do. No one will talk stats with me.
I wish I could entertain that conversation, but I am so far out of my depth when it comes to actually like that level of stuff. Like you kept talking about clutch, and I was like, I think I understand what he's talking about.
That's but when you grasp something really hard,
and then he said something about whip, and I was like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, so be warned.
No.
I think Greg tried to avoid talking about that stuff.
Yeah, I think you egged him on because you wanted. But no, the whole conversation was great because it was more about the park and the city and what he does. And then at the end, we got some of that nice talking about the team and the stats and all that fun stuff.
It's a really interesting job. He's a really interesting guy. Anyways, before we get into that, let's do our usual.
Yeah. So you want to start? How has your week been? How you been? It's been a while.
Right.
I haven't seen you in a while.
I know. We finally got the podcast out, so people have been listening to them. That's exciting.
It is.
We haven't got any emails yet, so please, listener@eeriereader.com. The first one that sends us an email, we'll read it, right?
Right,
no matter what it says.
We'll read it.
No matter what.
So we'll read
send us an email. We'll read it. It can be like, you guys suck. I want to eat your brains, signed zombie. We will read that.
Yeah. In dramatic voice, reenactment. We'll do it.
All right. So what's on your mind?
What's on my mind? That Grand Theft Auto came out. It costs about $200 million to make. On its first day, it made $800 million.
Wow.
And
Which chapter is this?
This is the fifth installment, or the fifth numbered one. Now, there's been more than five games, obviously, but this is GTA 5.
Right. Have you played the others?
Yeah, I've played all of them. I mean, growing up, that's kind of Grand Theft Auto. It is one of those touchstones for gamers.
Yeah,
For better or worse.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It's just something that we all collectively play. And also, Rockstar, the developers of Grand Theft Auto, they treat the game as like the snapshot of culture, and they try to show this moment in time. And they do a pretty good job of it in most parts, but a lot of times it's some grisly stuff. I mean, playing the game, like you could definitely tell that, they are making a game after Breaking Bad came out. just like simple things like that.
Well, before we get into 5, right? 4 was like the big one that came
4
out,
was
right?
The big
this
one
sort
that
of was
the very
transformative.
Yeah.
And that got good reviews despite the, you know, the content. Or...
Right, because the story of 4, 4 came out when the kind of in the early stages of the Xbox 360 and the PS3, which is this current gen that we're in.
Right.
And it came out, and the story was about this immigrant worker. He was like a, you know, he was a...
From Eastern Europe.
You know, he was like a gangbanger, a criminal over there, and he came here and he was looking to reform. But unfortunately, that was not the case. And he had to kind of go through this whole process of trying to kind of get out of the game and leaving a massive piles of body behind him. But it was interesting because there was some real character depth. Like, he was a character. He wasn't just a dude that was like laughing and shooting people. He was kind of struggling with the situation. Now, whether the game actually connected with that story, with the fact that you're killing everybody, that's a whole nother conversation.
Right.
But still, it did a lot to change the game a little bit.
Not only character development, but also, from what I understand, the detail of the world and the sort of boundary.
It was massive. Yeah. It got big. You know, the game became much more, it's getting, because even in San Andreas, Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, which was a PlayStation 2 installment, they try to make a game that is simulation life as much as possible. You know what I mean? Like, so for example, in the most recent Grand Theft Auto 5, I mean, the one character goes to a therapist, and you have therapy sessions where you talk to your therapist. Yeah,
that's hilarious.
You can go golfing, you can go running, you can go biking, you can go scuba diving, you can go watch a movie. You can go home and sit in your couch and watch TV in a game. And they have programming. They have like hours and hours of content that they made for you to watch fake TV. Like it's that. I mean, that's why they say $200 million to make. That's why, because there's just all of this stuff in there.
How long have you had this game?
I picked it up when it came out. I haven't had a time to super play it. Like I've unlocked all the characters. And then the one interesting with Grand Theft Auto 5 is it's not just one character you play as. You play as three characters, and you can jump from persona to persona.
What's the setting for this?
L.A.
Okay.
So it's basically kind of taking its poke at L.A. and then the desert areas surrounding L.A. And Yeah, I mean, so far it's interesting. I mean, there's definitely a lot of problems with it. I mean, I think even now that we're in this post, when games are kind of like transforming a lot right now too, because they're kind of going through a lot. I mean, the biggest thing right now is misogyny in video games. And that's kind of coming under fire by a lot of critics, and rightfully so. But I think the biggest thing so far that has kind of really torn me on this new Grand Theft Auto is there's this torture scene that's pretty intense, and you have to enact it as a player. There's no, like, it's different to, you know, when you watch Zero Dark 30 and you watch them waterboarding people. It's one thing, because you know it in your mind that, yeah, this is something that we did. This is something that we as a culture did. But then it's another thing when you have to do it. When is you have to push a button that then waterboards a person. Like, right. it changes the dynamic to the point where I don't want to do this, but I have to do it. In order, like, if I don't do this, the game's over here. This is where the game ends. And that's weird, right?
Yeah.
And so I don't know how much, you know, sure, you could say they're doing it for, like, that shock and to question you, but it definitely brings some things into the light that I don't think are talking about. Because a lot of people seem to be pretty hung up on just the fact that, you know, killing people again. Grand Theft Auto, violence, video games. This is why we have all the mass shootings in our country, is because of things like this. And they're really easy scapegoating. Whereas I think Rockstar is trying to, and I think they always have been, trying to force a much more larger conversation to happen. Mm-hmm. Being like, look, we're presenting our culture. Like, our job in our mind is we're trying to present what this slice of time is, like what the 2000s are. This is the 2000s. You know? Like, this is what we existed. This is what we experienced. And better or worse, you're going to experience it in a game.
So do you think that torture scene was forcing you to descend into darkness?
I guess.
We talked about Breaking Bad. It's right. Like, you know, forcing you on a similar character trajectory?
Yeah, yeah, a little bit.
In a way, like,
well, the one character, because one of the characters you play as is definitely he's a psychopath. Like, he's just a straight-up, he's a psychopath. I mean, he's definitely deranged in some way. And the other character, Michael, who's a little bit more straight-laced, you could tell that he is also sort of psychopathic a little bit because, you know, he was a bank robber. He's got like almost like an alter ego. He's like a dual personality. But Trevor, which is the guy that does the torturing, you know, he's very much like that dude. You know, he's a psychopath, just period. And you have to play as a psychopath, and so you're trying to put yourself in that mind. And whereas, it's just weird because you think about that scene and what that game is to people, and there is a segment of the population of people who play that game who are like, hell yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Like, this is so cool, they put this in a video game, right? And then there's another segment of the population, which I am in, and I'm like, I don't want to do this.
Yes,
like, I didn't want this to be a part of the game. I mean, even like the drugs and all that stuff that's in the game, I don't really deal with it because unless I have to, but like there's strip clubs in the game, right?
Yeah.
I don't really go in there, you know, because I don't need to go in a game. Like, I don't need to see what pixelated boobs look like, you know, like that's not necessary for me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go in there and go, ooh, yeah, you know, that's just not me anymore.
Do that laugh again. That
was ooh, you know what I mean? It's like the Beavis and Butthead laugh, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just like, and so it's just weird because, but I think the reason why the game is that way is because it's $200 million. The thing's got to appeal to everybody.
Yeah.
And so you can't just make a game based solely on what you believe. You kind of have to, like, you're spending $200 million.
That's funny. When I play video games, I can never be the bad guy. You know, like,
right.
in the games that have, like, World War II games, I can never play the Nazis.
Right. Yeah.
Even though, like, you know, they have cool tanks or planes or whatever, it's like, no, I just can't go there.
Right, I just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
I just don't want to.
Yeah.
It's not for me.
Yeah.
I mean, someone might like it, but I don't. I'd rather just, you know, I'll be an American. I'll play with a French shoulder. I don't care.
I have never played Grand Theft Auto. It's just never appealed to me. I'm like, why do I want to go around and punch hookers in the face?
The weird thing is like, it's such a known quantity that I don't even think you have to play it really anymore.
No, I'm intrigued by the ideas. I mean, when I heard about 4, I wouldn't mind checking it out or seeing it. But, you know, and certainly the concepts of the game
are
fascinating.
It is really fascinating, and it is really interesting. And, I mean,
you can veer off. What's interesting to me is storytelling, right?
Right.
And in most, like, the BioWare games are...
They're very linear, right?
Yeah, they're linear, and the writers lay out all the, you know, and I guess in if you go along the story structure, you know, 5, right?
Yeah.
It's all laid out for you, and you just go on these different paths, right?
Right.
You have, but they, you know, the storytellers create the paths that you can go on. There's
and also the fact that the world's open, it allows a lot for more incidental story, incidental narratives that happen. So I was just playing this game, I got in my car, and this cop car ran over, and like there's a drug bust that happened right across the street. Right after I got done towing a truck, it was weird, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like that stuff can happen, but, Yeah, I mean, I had to pick it up because I have to know these. Like, I mean, me personally, like, I sure I could critique it, and I know what Grand Theft Auto is. I don't have to play it, but I felt like I had to get in there to really know. And so far, I'm happy I did, because I think they're doing a lot of very interesting things.
Yeah.
And I think it's fun. I think a piece of game, which is a piece of culture, much like a film or anything else, I think it can be good on some respects, and also you can disagree with it on other respects, and everyone can walk away feeling okay about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I think that goes along with like Dexter and Breaking mm-hmm, Bad, mm-hmm. where you are lured into this world of evil,
right.
and you enjoy watching it, and then I haven't seen Dexter, but I know Breaking Bad, like the television program makers are punishing its audience by forcing them to endure places they don't want to be, but
right.
they've been sucked in by this narrative.
Right. I mean, and Breaking Bad, that's like wrapping up this weekend too.
Yeah,
and so everything's kind of coming to this big head, and it's really interesting to kind of watch how that's happening too, because I mean, anyone who's been watching Breaking Bad, now I'm not super caught up. I'm like a couple seasons behind, but still it's like you're watching these people that started doing these things for maybe good reasons, but are getting kind of going down like the Heart of Darkness path, like Apocalypse Now. They're going native or whatever.
Yeah.
And you know that if this is going to be based on any form of reality, that nothing is going to end well.
How far are you along? Are you up right up to the, are you caught up?
No, I'm not. I'm a couple seasons behind. So.
Yeah,
but my wife's been watching. So
I just, last night I watched episode 8 of season 5 on Netflix, and that's where I'm at. I'm nowhere near where everyone else is, but he's definitely turned the corner in this season.
Right.
He's bad guy. There's no doubt.
And it's interesting.
In the episode 8 that I saw, Hank, the brother, had like all these guys in jail, and they were starting to talk. And then, spoiler alert for those folks like John who are behind, but he has Walt has all these guys killed in prison. 9 guys killed simultaneously.
Wow.
All at once, within 2 minutes of each other, right? And Hank's investigating this case, and Walt's over at his house, and Hank comes home, and he's like totally depressed. And he like pours Walt a drink, and he gets a drink, and they sit down. He's like, Hank starts talking about his summer job he had in high school, which, by the way, is great writing, because when you talk about something without talking about it, which is what Hank does in that scene, it's very powerful. You know what? And then by the end of this monologue, he's like, I should have appreciated it when I was there. Because, like, all I could think about at the time was being sunburnt, mosquitoes. It's like, I'm tired of chasing monsters.
Right.
But what he doesn't know, right, is Walt is the monster he's chasing.
Right.
That just killed all these dudes and derailed his investigation.
Like, for the nth time, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's always been this cat and mouse between
them. No, this is different, though. It's been Walter, evading his own, like, evading these guys trying to get him.
Right.
Who are, and he's making the product for them. But now he's the top dog. He's calling the shots. He's the one killing. He's the one other people are trying to get away from. He is the monster, and it's brilliant. You're like, oh yeah, he's the monster. I went back after there was an episode 51 where it's his 51st birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And went back and watched the very first episode after that. I don't even know why. I think I was talking about it. I teach a class in creative writing. I was talking about it with the kids. And I saw the first episode, and it's his 50th. The show starts on his 50th birthday. And it was just really interesting. I don't want to derail the Grand Theft Auto, but...
Right, but no, this is sort of related.
Yeah, but something disturbs me about that show.
Right.
I like The Wire better than the show.
The Wire?
I don't think
that's a masterpiece, you know what I mean? Yeah.
I think Breaking Bad is a better technical movie. It's the screenshots, the shots, the camera angles, the constant self-referral to itself where you can... you're almost subconsciously brought back to different parts in the progression mm-hmm. of this character. It seems like the whole, the series was already, it was all figured out, and that he had arced it from beginning to end, and it was a really
everything there is there for a precise reason, and that's gonna play a part later on,
right? And The Wire is messier. The Wire is like different characters. The characters aren't the same from season to season. So it is a little sloppier and looser, but I think what The Wire has that Breaking Bad doesn't is a soul or a heart or any kind of human compassion. And Breaking Bad just seems so cold and dark.
Yeah,
to me,
I think that's why I stopped watching it, because I was watching it with my wife and I was really enjoying it, but then I was just like, man, this is just grim.
Yeah,
like there is no hope.
No,
like
no,
not at all. And like in from watching how they were been moving the characters, like I said, I'm even really far behind.
Yeah,
but like you can tell that like if this ends on any sort of hope note of hope, that's bullshit. You know what I mean? Like they would have just like burned everybody.
Yeah,
and so you can tell where they're going, and I really appreciate that dedication because I love. And, you know, you say you teach writing, but, like, good. I love tragic heroes. Tragic stories are the best because they're the most believable because people are who they are.
Yeah.
And it takes heaven and earth to change people. Yeah. It really does. And for that stuff to happen, like, for characters to change, like, on a season-to-season basis or an episode-to-episode basis, it's like, that's bullshit. I don't buy it anymore. I love the stories where it's like, no, like, the person is who they are from the beginning to the end. And you can see all parts of them, and you can see them gravitate to certain parts of them more than before. But that was all there originally. All of those moments were already there, and they're waiting for the right moments to trigger them to go down that path.
I feel like the Breaking Bad does that.
But yeah, no, it does. Yeah. And I think it's really – that's why I liked it. But then it's just like, oh, but this is also just really grim.
Yeah. So, I haven't played Grand Theft Auto, any of it. In incarnations, but it feels like maybe a similar experience.
It's interesting. I mean, like
technically good.
It's technically really cool. There are parts of it, like I said, I don't like the storytelling. The fact that there's three characters and you get to kind of take part in all three of them, because like I said, there's Michael, who is like, you know, he used to be a bank robber. He supposedly died, he has a wife and two kids, and he bought a mansion in L.A. and he's trying to like reform himself. He's trying to stay out of the game. The one character is his name's Franklin. He's like he was a black kid who's a gangbanger. And he's trying to not be a gangbanger. I mean, he understands that criminality is going to be part of his life, but he doesn't want to be caught up in the straight up like thug life. He wants to get out of that. He wants to rob banks, for instance. And Trevor, who was Michael's old bank robbing partner, he's now a meth dealer in like the desert.
Oh, right.
So yeah. That's the Breaking Bad part, right?
Absolutely.
And so you get to see all these personalities collide, and I think that's what's really strong about Grand Theft Auto, because before it was so singular focused on Roman. No, not Roman. What's his name? Nico. Nico Bellic was the character of Grand Theft Auto 4. And it was so centrally focused on him, and that's why it was so unbelievable for him to be trying to get out of the game, but like all at the same time, he has to do all these heinous things.
Yeah.
Now they have these three different characters that are all different points in their lives, and it makes sense for Trevor to go on these rampages and kill everybody, but it doesn't make sense for Franklin to do that because he doesn't want to do that. And now they have this leeway to do that while still telling all these stories. And then it's like the shandification of story of narration, right? So you have this like, you ever read Thomas Shandy?
No.
So it's this weird book about how narrative should be. And it's like this, it's basically like a collection of diaries from this British town, but it's like really non sequitur. But it kind of creates this world.
Yeah.
And what that does, it allows you to kind of piece it together and get your own story, kind of fill meaning in, on your own part as a viewer, an audience member. And it's an interesting way of telling a story because it's a lot more believable. Because when you switch from character to character, you meet them at that moment in time and they were doing something. Like the game doesn't stop whether you're playing a character or not. They're still doing things. And when you hop in on them, they'll be at a tennis lesson or something. And it's just really interesting to see these portraits of these different like people that live in this world. Quote-unquote world, because obviously they're based on real things, but obviously they're not real, you know. So it's interesting, and I mean just that alone is enough to kind of keep me playing, because I want to see where this all goes, even regardless of the things I'm not super happy about, you know what I mean, like the blatant misogyny and the torture stuff, and you know, because the torture stuff's weird because like the whole thing's about trying to stop a terrorist cell in LA or Los Santos as they call it, and so it's really just like, okay, so, yeah, we have to find this, you know, obviously Arab-looking person in this game. And part of it is catching one of his Arab brothers or relatives and then torturing him.
Nice.
So it's like, little, like, you know, it's on the nose. You know what I mean? It's like, remember that? Remember when this was, like, our fear of, you know, this was part of our culture? It's like, yes, I remember, Rockstar. Thank you for reminding me. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's been me that's been me the past week and a half, so.
Sweet.
Yeah. How about you?
So, I had three things I want to pick from them. One of them, though, we already talked about was television. I want to talk about, you know,
Breaking Bad
and The Wire. And like what's so that's cool. We can toss that. The other two, one is, I don't know, I had this friend on Facebook, Jason, who brought up the Nazgul, you know, from Lord of the Rings,
mm-hmm.
and wondered kind of what the hell are they? You know, how do they work? Like, why are they afraid of water? And the other thing, which would be fun to talk about, the other thing is, I think our very first show we talked about civility and comments.
Oh,
on
yeah,
Facebook.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of things happened recently. Sort of a backlash against internet free for all culture. There was the Popular Science.
Yep.
Closed down its comments. I wrote a couple things about that already. Louis C.K. ragging on smartphones on Conan. And then Jonathan Franzen's long, admittedly pedantic tirade against modern culture and Twitter and that kind of thing. Do you have a favorite in this?
Yeah, let's go into that one because actually I was just talking about this too because I was talking about this with one of my friends and maybe this will relate. Let's start with the Louis C.K. thing because that was more about cell phones and his kids, right?
Yes, but it is about cell phone culture and how always being on your cell phone or your smartphone is removing you from what's important about being a human.
Right? Yes, yeah.
Yes, it was about his kids, right? But, you know, he was saying that, you know, the phone, what the kid was doing on the phone was taking away from that interaction with that other human being. And more, you know, he was talking about his own self, like not using cell phones because we have a tendency to always want to jump on our cell phone because we don't want to have that moment where you have to face that dark, deep, empty side of you.
Right. So this is the thing that happened to me recently. So I was talking, so I do a website and we post articles, small articles.
Yeah.
And I use Justified. I justify my text on the web because I like it. I like justified text. And I mean, I went to design school, and I know that justified text turns text into blocks.
Yes.
And eyes like repeatable patterns, and that's why I'm going to do it, because it's easier on the eyes. My eyes like it better with justified text. My partner said, why would you justify text? No one else does justified text. Why? You can't prove that. I was like, no, I can't prove it, but I just like it. It's something that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I mean, what well, is it? Give me an argument for why we shouldn't use it. Like, tell me why I shouldn't use it, and maybe you can convince me.
Yeah.
And what he proceeded to do, instead of telling me why he believes it's not, he linked to me various websites that don't use it. As like, that's his argument.
Yeah.
Well, Polygon doesn't do it.
Yeah.
This website doesn't do it. That website doesn't do it. I'm like, okay, you're linking me to places. That's not, you're not talking to me.
Yeah.
You're doing the equivalent of like looking on a phone. So, ha ha, you're wrong.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I mean, we can talk about this. I'm not like so diehard on justified text that I'm like going to like just, you know, this isn't like health care. This isn't an abortion issue. You know what I mean? This is just justified text. Let's talk it out.
Yeah.
And it never happened.
Well, obviously,
but it's like
that's a failure of communication, right?
Right. Like, yeah. But that's kind of what the cell phone thing is, right? It's a failure to communicate.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's just all part of that same culture. It's all part of that, like, oh, I'll find the answer online. Like, we have an argument. Instead of just arguing, instead of just like talking it out and having a discussion about whatever, you know, even when you're at the bar, something comes up, you go, oh, such and such is the best baseball player ever, right? And you go, okay, then you start talking about it. But now you have a cell phone, you bring it up, and go, no, actually, technically, this dude's the best one, because I just looked it up on ESPN.com right now, and this is who they're saying is the hottest. You know what I mean? It just removes all of that.
Yeah.
That human interaction of just talking about a thing and having a different opinion and having different opinions being okay.
Right. I mean, maybe that's what, at the center of it, is what Louis C.K. was talking about, because Popular Science turned off its comments because it's really interesting. I probably should look it up. I should probably look it up, right?
Right, yeah. Bust out your phone right now.
And quote it. But essentially what they cited as a reason is that comments, they found some studies that showed that comments, negative comments and uncivil comments on an article changed people's perception of the article and made them question the validity
of the actual article.
And that in this context today where we kind of see expertise open up to debate from amateurs, right? That where scientific certainty, this is kind of the quote, scientific certainty is now a topic for debate on a television show between two people. You know, that isn't how science works, right?
Right.
It's not a debate between science, scientific facts, and somebody who doesn't know them, right? And
it's the debate two between, yeah.
It's not one opinion versus another where you discuss the differences. It's
no.
This is scientific fact, and this isn't, right?
This is the study that I ran. This is the study that you ran. Now let's talk about those studies.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, because we both ran studies, and we both have results that we can point to and say, hey, this is what we found when we did X to Y.
Right.
I'm like, well, this is what I found when I did B to Y.
Right.
Like, okay, well,
that's scientific discourse, right? And so they were saying is, why should we run comment sections to question the validity of the content we're producing that's scientific certainty or from this particular methodology, and the comments are not, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
and also it just fails like the common discourse. Like there's just no good discourse that has been coming up, which is another big problem they raise. It's like there's just no civility in our discourse.
Right. Here. And that's what YouTube is also changing its common policy.
Yeah,
have you
seen
that?
Yeah, yeah. They're getting
they're using Google Plus as the engine for their comments. So what it does is instead of the most recent comments being on the top, it's the most relevant comments will now be stacked on the top. And it gives power to the uploader to I guess blacklist certain terms and also do moderation before publishing. So YouTube comments will no longer be free for all.
Well, we hope. We hope they're no longer.
I mean, it's all optional for the
uploader.
We'll
see. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll see.
Like, you know.
But yeah, all the hate speech might go away.
Or be shrunk to the bottom.
Right.
You know, or never approved.
But that's censorship, man.
That's the question, right?
Like, no, it's not a question.
The original intent of the internet, in the original, those early listserv groups, the early discussion forums, it was a free-for-all, and it was good because it was the only place that you could actually have discourse outside accepted and approved places, right? You couldn't get published in a newspaper if the editor didn't approve of your style or your opinion, right? Which is a problem, right? We talked about this with mainstream media, right?
Yeah, but I mean, you think go back to those earlier access to the internet, those earlier boards. I mean, that was you had to be a privileged class to kind of get in there to begin with.
Absolutely,
it wasn't really for everybody. Everyone could technically get there, but not everyone was on there. You know what I mean? Now everyone has a computer. Everyone has a smartphone.
Right.
Whereas before, I mean, you had to have a computer. You had to have a 56K modem or whatever. You had to know how to connect to BBSs.
But still, in those early groups, you would have these months-long flame wars.
Oh yeah, naturally.
That would
not to the level now. I mean,
they set the stage, right? I mean, you had trolls. Also, you had like all those, all the different types of trolls were long identified before smartphones came.
The other big thing back then too was anonymity. You know, back
yeah,
then,
we talked about this.
Yeah, we talked about this before.
You feel like anonymity.
That's the biggest thing.
Yeah,
people are themselves now on the internet, and they when you are attacked, when your personality is being attacked.
Yeah,
that's a lot more. I guess. Puts a lot more impetus on you to react than if it was just, 420 Bong Lord XXX, like your internet persona. Because if you look at the people who are doing the hate speech, those are their names.
Right.
They're nonsense names. It's not like Thomas J. something or other is going to get on there and call you all these really terrible words.
Right.
But Bong Lord 420, he definitely is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The third thing was a Franzen piece in The Guardian, and he wrote this thing, this indictment of modern culture, and he said a lot of things in it, and it was extreme. It was like 6,000 words, which I totally loved because I write that shit all the time. It's sort of framed around this obscure fin de siècle, like 1890s Austrian pamphleteer.
Okay.
Right? So people are like, it's pretentious, it's pedantic, it's long, like it's somewhat misogynistic, although I didn't necessarily see that. But a lot of people don't like Franzen. Apparently he's a jerk in real life, whatever. But they read this thing and saw indictments, personal attacks on themselves rather than like actually reading the fucking thing and like, commenting on what he actually said, But one of the things he said, which I found very interesting, was he was talking about what it takes to be a successful writer nowadays, right? And obviously that's something that's near and dear to me. But he was saying to succeed in the modern world as a writer, you have to be really good at he called it like yakking. So being, do really well on social media, self-publishing and self-promotion. So you would pay – there are these groups out there that you can pay and they will – write reviews for you on your book, and they'll push up the ranking on Amazon of your book. So when someone says, "Give me the best top 100 books, your book will be in the top there to increase sales, right? Mm-hmm. So, they'll do like – they'll purchase quantities of your book for you to drive the sale numbers up so that other people will buy it, right?
Right.
And he said that Franzen was saying that that's what you need to do to be a successful writer, or certainly that's the model that Amazon is pushing, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, big publishers can't really compete with that, and probably they are going to start –
I'm copying it, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, we'll print the book. You sell it. I mean, they already do that now, but they'll probably continue to do so. But he was saying in a world where that's true, that the folks who like to sit down and write long contemplative things and aren't necessarily into the yakking mm-hmm. and the self-promotion aren't going to succeed as writers, and that's a bad thing for writing. And I think that's spot on. I think it's astute and maybe even something that's not at all controversial. And yet somehow there's a huge backlash from writers who do a lot of self-promotion and they use Twitter. On Twitter there was a big pushback against what he had to say. So I feel like all these things together show a kind of trend where people are – there's a backlash against the internet. You know?
With that part about the publishing, because that actually strikes pretty near and dear to kind of what I do. Because on the other show that I run is mostly talking to people who create things. I talk to people who make independent video games. And one of the things that they're quickly realizing is that they're living in a world now where you can't go down to your basement, spend months, years making a game, coming out, and even though that game might be the most awesome thing in the universe, come out and have it just sell itself and people to find it and then them to have that financial success. Like, those days are over. And what is increasingly happening is that they're finding out that the ratio of making a thing and then telling people that you made a thing, ideally, in an ideal world, would be something maybe like 90-20 or 90-10 or you know, 95-5, you know, where 95% of the time is making the thing, 5% telling people about that you're making a thing. But the actual reality is, and this is from our own experience, is about 60-40, telling people that you're doing a thing, and 40% doing a thing.
Right.
And it's just because of how fragmented we are is, I think, a key component of it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we have access to all this information, we need people to, you know, assimilate it for us and tell us what's important. There's a lot of noise, like the signal and the noise argument, right?
Yeah, sure.
And, but it's a very true thing, you know. Think about how many writers there are now. Now, before, they had to go through all these proper means, like through publishers or through houses, mm-hmm. and those people would kind of help find the things that were important and uplift them.
Right.
And so, you know, you look at, you know, I mean, you would probably know better than this, but there are certain publishing houses, I'm sure, that had a certain type of book that they liked to publish or
absolutely,
a certain style. And that was something that that was great for consumers because all of a sudden you could – Motown, right? That's another perfect example.
Yeah.
You know, when you got a Motown record, you're going to get a Motown sound.
Right.
It might be different. It might be, you know, it might be a woman, it might be a guy, it might have more oohs, more ahs, more doo-wop, whatever, but it was Motown. It had a feel. but what the problem was, now that we're all these big publishers, they got really big. And they got really choosy. And they're really big to the point where, like, when they back a book, they need to know that that book is going to pay back. And so what happened was we had this big pushback, right? Everyone's like, all right, well, we have the internet. We're going to do it all on our own.
Yeah.
And so now you have all these talented, extremely talented writers doing it on their own, which they're finding success. And now you have all these people who are like, oh, if they did it, I can do it.
Right.
And now the marketplace is flooded with so much stuff. Some of it's good, some of it's bad.
Most of it's bad, 99% bad.
Right. Yeah. But that's just how it works, right? Yeah. That's just how process creation works. And so now how do we go back to – how do we keep this inherent awesomeness of people being able to do what they want and say what they want to say? And because we're getting better stuff out of it. Like the books, games, movies, all the stuff from independent, like mm-hmm. independently published stuff is so much better because there's so much more vision in there. There's so much more personality and all the stuff that's getting put out. But the problem is that how do we now start, you know, assimilating the information and making sure that the right stuff's rising to the top?
Before I think that's less of a problem than the money.
Right.
Right.
Well, the money's part of that.
Well, perhaps, but people want stuff for free.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, how many...
That's true, but, like, if you... People want stuff for free, but people also want to know that what they buy is good. You know what I mean? Like, why do people defend things so hard after they purchase something? Because they don't want anyone saying the thing that they bought was bad. You know? Like, that's why, like, I mean, that's super prevalent in game culture from like kind of what I deal with. Mm-hmm. Like that's why you have fanboyism, right? The whole Xbox versus PlayStation thing.
Sure.
Because they're defending their turf because they just spent $600 some on a thing and they don't want someone else saying, "Oh, you fucked up."
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that's a big deal. And no, money is a big thing. Yeah, people don't want to pay a lot for stuff, but I do, you know, and this is something that this I believe, you know, as I wag my finger in the air, that if I see something that is of worth, that I will put money for it because I understand that for things to be of real value, mm-hmm. it can't be free. I can't think of this is a perfect example. Like this is what I always equate it to. So on the iPhone, right, you have 99-cent games.
Yeah.
Tons of them.
Yeah.
Right. Go to McDonald's. They have 99-cent food. Have you ever purchased food for 99 cents and been like, you know what? This was satisfying. My soul feels fulfilled because I had this 99-cent piece of food.
Yeah, but you can go down to the greengrocer and get 99 cents worth of apples and be totally fulfilled.
Right, yeah, because, yeah, exactly. And so, but the point is, like, you know, if you're going to race down to this common denominator of like, things being for free or so cheap, you're going to get shit. Like, there is good things at that price point, but they are competing, they're trying to compete with that. When I think the other option and the better option is to, is to make the value statement and to stand by yourself. I mean, that's a tough call to make because that's scary, right?
You know, it's,
but I think you can find the people to support that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Kickstarter is proof of that.
Right. Well, Kickstarter, I mean, I was going to bring up Kickstarter when you were talking about the 60-40 ratio. I mean,
right.
Kickstarter is the example of all talk, no product.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So 30 days
of all talking.
Yeah. People give you money for talking about yourself.
Right.
Right? That's where the reward is. It's not in the actual producing.
Well, it's in the thing. And I've seen, and actually, so there's various ways to run a Kickstarter. And actually, there's a Kickstarter that's happening right now where we talk to the developer.
Yeah.
He's put up a Kickstarter asking for $27,000. When we talked to him, he was already at $270,000. And according to the track record, like how he's trending, he's going to break $1 million. Now, we've seen a lot. I watch a lot of Kickstarter videos because I talk to a lot of people that run these things. And that's just kind of what my day job is.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about his video is there's none of him talking. All it is a 1 minute clip of the game that he made. And now it's cut and it's showing off a bunch of pieces, but it's just music, no dialogue,
right.
Just the visuals and just some of the music from the game. That's it. And it is blowing up to this degree that it's like has everyone, and I've been talking about this with all my friends, like what is about this one that is doing so well? Because typically you see people trying to like pitch it. They're trying to sell you on this idea, this dream they have. They want to sell it because they need the funding to make it happen.
But that's, again, we're back to the idea that those that self-promote succeed and those that don't.
Right.
Right.
And the weird thing is you have to self promote. You have
That's the thing. That's my point.
Right.
Like, yeah, right. They're getting rewarded for the yakking that Franzen is denigrating.
I think we need publishers. I think we need smaller publishers to start springing up. And I think we'll start seeing it soon.
Well, it's hard, you know, especially with, you know, I can't speak about video game content, but certainly writing content. The web is built on writing, on text.
Right, right.
99.9% of it has been provided absolutely at no cost to the reader.
Yeah.
And with very little pay to the writer.
Right. Well, I think that's why you need publishers.
But no one pays for it. Like, who would pay for writing?
Well, yeah. I mean,
the current gets me so mad with the pirate. I mean, I used to be a pirater of songs, you know, back in the day. Napster came out. I signed up for that, you know, in the first iteration. But now you just, you know, at least a musician has the opportunity to get money from a performance.
Yeah, but you see things like, but I don't know, because with musicians, there are so many more platforms now for them to sell their music very easily.
Again,
but
you sell promotion, right?
But Bandcamp, that's just putting their things up on a website and putting a price on it or a value per track, and people then make or pay what you want, and people then respond to that.
But is that part of music making? I mean, we're talking. It's a different task. It's a different kind of skill than music making, right? I guess I'm going back to Franzen here, like you know. What if you're not into that? What if you're into playing music and playing live gigs? What if you own a computer?
Right. Well, then they find people who do those things for them.
But then again, you're back to the thing. This is your self-promotion thing.
But you need. But the thing is, like, you need someone making noise for you. Before it was publishers, and the thing is like maybe like I said, maybe we just need more smaller publishers that aren't trying to be the top dog. You know, sometimes like I think there's this big, and it has a lot to do with, I guess, part of some of like our own culture where it's like, you know, not only is it enough to be successful, but we have to be like wildly successful.
I keep going back to this thing, the blowback that these things to me are all interconnected, like the disassociation from other people, the discourse and comments, the yakking of social media. It's not. I mean, it's a kind of thinking. It's a kind of existing online that isn't contemplative. It isn't deep. It isn't. But in order to succeed in these arts that maybe are deep and contemplative, that maybe do require a lot of solitude and thinking, that those aren't the skills that are commensurate with. With succeeding in this other arena of like crazy techno, I don't think there's a solution in computers to solve that problem. Like, I don't think so. I mean, you may disagree.
Yeah.
I guess maybe it's our age gap, right? Like, I grew up in a time before computers.
I think this also might just be the fields. I mean, the fields I come from a fine art background traditionally, and now I'm working in a digital space where I'm dealing with more interactive. Design with video games, stuff like that. But I mean, even going back to fine arts, like you fucking networking was critical. You had to network. Like if you didn't network, you didn't get anywhere.
Right.
Like it wasn't even about galleries. It wasn't even about showing galleries. It was about knowing who to talk to get your thing showed at, to have people to basically say, oh, that person's important.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe Franzen is harking back to the day of privilege and small class and closed doors.
Right.
And if you operate well
better?
Behind this,
was that better?
No, it isn't necessarily. Absolutely not. I mean, that's the thing. That's going back to the comments, right?
I
mean, one of the original things of the internet was to have this free for all, free discussion apart from the gatekeepers. Well, now what we're finding is the gatekeepers are important, right?
Yeah.
That they serve a role and
tastemakers are important,
right?
You know, all these things we hated.
Right. And we have to support this with our money, right?
I mean,
and I think it's not yet that we have, you know, some places, you know, like the, I think mobile games are a great example of people getting, I mean, 99 cent games, maybe they're cheap, but
they don't make any money off of them. Talking to the developers,
they don't make any money. 99
like
cents a game.
Like you have to be, if you're selling your game for 99 cents and you're not in the top like 10, top 100,
you don't make any money. Yeah,
you are not making money off of that.
Or musicians from, you know, like Pandora or the other online, you know, they get,
I mean, you know, that
a fraction of a penny
you know
per
even
play.
From writing for a blog like click ads, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
so minuscule.
Yeah, it doesn't get you anything.
Like so, you have to be getting, in order for click ads to be making any sort of profit, you're talking 1,000 hits.
So how do you make money then?
How do you make money? That's what I'm working on. That's what I've been working
on. It requires the consumer to pay more.
Right. It requires you going up to the consumer and saying, hey, this is the thing that I want to do.
Yeah.
This is what I plan on doing. And you've seen it. You've seen what I've done. In order for me to keep doing this,
you need to pay me.
There is a value proposition there. There is this is worth something. Now, is this worth something to you? And now the cool thing is we're starting to see a lot more web-based apps that are doing this, things like Subbable, Flatter, Patreon.
Yeah.
Basically, they set up these really easy ways for you to like, hey, you read that, and there's a little button, you click it, you donate. You send money that way.
We got to do this to the podcast.
Right. Well, no, that's what we plan on doing with ours. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the thing is, you have to say, like, this costs money.
Yeah. It doesn't cost much, but it costs time.
It costs time. And obviously, you know, if you like the thing that we're doing and you like us, then we want to invite you on that. We want to give you something more from that experience. But part of that would require some sort of, you got to pay for it. If you value something, you have to pay for it. It always comes down to that, right? Like, you have to support things with your money. And you have to, and that goes the opposite way, too. If you don't like something, if you don't like what something a company is doing or a practice, you vote with your dollar. More than anything else. More than like going, like, I believe in my own consumer habits way more than actually going to the polls here in America. Like, believe it or not. Like, you know, I haven't shopped at Walmart in years.
No.
I haven't eaten at McDonald's in years. And you know what? Sure, they'll be fine. You know what I mean? But whatever. They're not getting my money and I feel better about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
it sucks, but it sucks because that's slow change. You know what I mean? That's not like,
well, we're getting into a whole different arena of politics or whatever. But you're it's like changing consumer habits for climate change, for example, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a whole...
We're still debating that, too,
well,
right?
Yeah, I mean... so when you pair a free market argument for climate change, right, let the consumer decide, and then you double that with, like, intentionally sowing doubt in the issue, right? Then you have, like, a perfect storm of, like, nothing gets done, right?
Right.
So... You know, you could say the same thing about
it's like
McDonald's.
Macro, it's macro micro problems, right?
Right. You need good information and you need values. And
that's what I'm saying, Jay. Start making good, start giving the good information out there.
Nah, man. It's, I used to think, you know, when I first started blogging, you know, as a progressive liberal, I thought, oh, yeah, the purity of our arguments will shine through, you know, like,
right.
Because we use logic. And we did, you know, most of, you know, like food stamps. I wrote about food stamps this week.
That's unbelievable. I can't believe that food stamps work, right?
All the data show that food stamps work. All the data show
60% go to kids, too.
And the elderly. And those on food stamps are less likely to be on welfare as adults than those that aren't, right? So long term, it actually saves money for taxpayers and welfare payments.
But let's cut it. Let's cut that. We don't need that, right?
Yeah, people don't stand food stamps. So there's
the just world phenomenon.
Yeah,
it's
so
just right back to us.
I could go and present all of these arguments, you know, like they work, it's a good program, and it costs, you know, every dollar invested in food stamps results in about $1.75 in money for the economy, right? It's good for the economy.
Right,
it's good for, you know, future welfare. It's good, but you know, a lot of people buy into this idea. You know, it's like an emotional reaction. It just doesn't. The arguments don't work.
Right.
Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
I don't want to go down the rabbit hole, but the arguments of themselves don't work. You can show the benefits of a program, but it doesn't mean people will side with you. I mean, we talked about that in a previous one, right? People read stuff that disagree with them, and they find it only reinforces their original belief.
Yeah,
right?
But I think even like we were saying earlier, like, you know, you have to write the thing and then tell people that you wrote it. But I think it's hand in hand with activism. You know what I mean? Like, even locally, like, you know, there's things I want to get involved in because I believe in them, so I get involved in them.
Yeah.
You know, like the Erie Horror Fest and Independent Film Fest. I think those things are two awesome initiatives. I'm going to throw myself at them because I want those things to succeed.
Yeah.
And I guess you can't no longer sit in the ivory tower and send down scripture. You have to go down and get some wet work. You got to get your hands dirty.
I mean, certainly activism is a great way to affect.
Let's get out there. Let's go pick it right now.
Yeah, but I mean, I like, you know, maybe I'm old fashioned, but I like the idea of people thinking about things and coming up with interesting thoughts.
I wish that was still the case.
It still is. People do that, right?
Yeah, some people.
Yeah.
No, I don't think there are enough people do it anymore.
Yeah, you know, back to our topic. I mean, there's such a diverse, eclectic, and multitudinous, you know, set of voices on the internet.
Yeah, and also I think people are just trying to live. It's harsh out there, right?
It is very harsh.
Like, it's really harsh right now. Like, I have, like, my friend, you know, I have some friends that are really lucky with really good jobs, and I have friends who recently got laid off, and it is tepid.
It's tepid.
To say the best. So.
I guess, you know, who cares? What does it all mean? I don't know.
Friends and happiness.
Yeah.
That's what it all means, man. You gotta find solace somewhere. Or else you just drive yourself batty.
That's right. Pass the whiskey.
That's dude. Screw this. I'm out of here. Let's go drinking.
All right. It's a good segue. Up next, Greg Gagne.
Yeah.
Good interview.
Yeah, it was great. And, baseball. Let's go to the ballpark. There you go.
Oh, too late.
Yeah. Well, next season.
Psych.
Next season, we'll go.
Yeah, definitely. We should do one in the park. That would be fun.
Absolutely. We can definitely arrange that. All right. Well, awesome. Well, here you go. Enjoy. We're good to go.
Are we going to start?
We're all set. Whenever you want to dive into it, we're all good.
All right, let's go.
Hi.
Hi.
So who do we got in the studio, Jay?
Greg Gagne, the voice of the Seawolves, also media director.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah.
This is pretty much what I do.
I talked with you extensively before. I'm going to ask a lot of the same questions, but...
That's a typical reporter. You just ask the same things over and over again.
Ooh. Shots fired.
I've
hung around Craig Smiley long enough to know where it's like, all right, stick a microphone in somebody's face. What are you going to say?
Yeah. I know. But some of the stories that you told me were so awesome. I gotta pull them out again. But before we dive into like all that fun stuff,
mm-hmm.
I want to hear, you're a professional talker. I want to hear some advice.
Yeah.
How do you talk better on these things?
How do you talk better? You just got to get in the zone. Yeah. People always ask me, like, your voice changes when you're on the air. I said, no, it doesn't. I'm the same guy that I am in my office on the air. At the bar, that's a little different.
It's a little louder, right?
Yes, a little louder. The drinks go in, the levels keep going higher and higher. But no, I mean, it's a task every day. And because whether you're ready for it or not, people are tuning in to listen to you talk, so you better be on your game every night. And that's tough some nights because we play 142 games in 152 days, with some of those off days being travel days. So you really have to bring it every night you're on there because people will call you out. You know, I'll have people say, you didn't seem like you had it tonight.
Yeah.
Like, oh, thanks for noticing. But it's a grind what I do. And that's why it's nice this time of year because I can come do fun stuff like this and not have to be have that game face on every night. But that's really what it comes down to.
Do you have like warm ups? Like you have exercises that you do?
No, I don't think. No. Some guys sit there and some guys
don't
will
do
have
like
their
red leather, yellow leather stuff.
I don't do any of that garbage. if I start stumbling over my words, I'll stretch my mouth a little bit. But other than that, make weird faces. But I mean, some guys will have their green tea and their honey and their I don't mess around with that stuff.
I mean, I remember because in high school I did a little bit of acting, so there was like all the vocal warm-ups that people would do. And I know when I first started podcasting, just because I was like getting the shakes out, I would do that. Like I would like for like a half an hour before I had like a routine. Like I'd have to like brush my teeth, even though like I'm not talking to anyone here. Like I'm talking over the internet. Like I said, like brush my teeth because I don't have bad breath. It was like, it's just like stuff like that.
Yeah, it's funny because the minute the gates open, you've seen it, Jay. We're getting pulled in all different directions.
Right.
That sometimes I'm just rolling into the booth 5 minutes before the game even starts, so I don't have time to sit there and do my voice exercises.
Yeah, yeah,
I wouldn't even know what to do. Right. I mean, other than stretch my mouth every once in a while, that's. That's all I do. It's tough though if you have a cold and you're trying to. Yeah. That's when you're sucking down tea and honey and doing everything.
What's your go-to when you're like, when you're fighting a sickness and you have to like perform and like do your thing?
Liquor.
Yeah. nice. Perfect.
No, I actually that
the CC hot, did not hear
hot,
that.
Yes. Hot toddies all the way.
The old radio guy in Altoona, who's now the GM of State College, he told me once, he was like, I was struggling all night. I've been sick all week. And they had a bar on Sweet Level and went over and did a shot of Jägermeister. And he said that helped clear him up for the broadcast. I have never done that. No, I have never drank.
No.
Never any alcohol in the air. And I will advocate not doing that because I have the potty mouth when that starts happening. But no, I mean, that's you just try and suck down green tea and honey as much as you can. And that's. I'm a coffee drinker, so sometimes and I drink a lot of coffee, and so there'll be nights where at the end of the night I'm like I could tell I drink too much coffee that day because I'm really hoarse and because that doesn't do any help to your throat at all.
No,
no.
So that sucking down cough drops, those sprays are great. What do they call those? They come like even CVS has their own little brands of red or green and you just spray it down your throat and that's. That's fantastic stuff, and it lasts for about 10 minutes, and then you're spraying it again.
Between innings, right?
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Yeah, I have to say, at the park, the thing I'm most impressed about, it's great that you call the whole game, and that's an art in itself, but the pre-game PA announcement that you do on field, you're sitting there, the camera's on you, you're on your little chair, and you speak right into the PA, and like everyone in the park can hear you, and you can hear yourself, right?
Yeah.
But you just belt it out like it's nothing. Do you have a script you work from?
No, it's just all ad lib.
That's crazy.
One time I froze.
Did you?
And it was, had it been 2010? 9 or 10. And I was interviewing the Portland radio guy who used to be in Erie. And we're just sitting there bantering back and forth. And all of a sudden, I just freeze. And I'm looking at him and I'm looking at the crowd. And I'm like, all right, we'll be right back. And just... 10 seconds of just total awkward silence.
Yeah.
Got a couple of boos, and it happens.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I guess everyone has their off night.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's why having a co-host helps, because when you have an off night, when you pause, the other person usually notices that and, like, will pick it up.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
And for the most part, I don't have a co-host on the air during the broadcast.
So you do it all on your own?
Mostly all by myself. I mean, I had an intern this past year that did some innings
How was that? Was that nice to have him?
Yeah,
I mean, you, regardless of like trying to like teach a dude something, but like
that's the thing. You're always. Yeah. I feel like when I have somebody on the air with me that's not as experienced, you have to be the teacher a lot of times and try and lead them into what they should say. Some of the best times I've had on the air were with some of my friends in the Eastern League. I would go on their broadcast. I'd give the intern a few innings on the Seawolves broadcast. Yeah. Go over and just pop on the visiting broadcast for a while. And when you're with someone who knows what they're doing and does it for a living, it's great to just because it's just natural and you connect and it's really fun doing that.
That's awesome.
We've often talked about doing like a, and I don't know how we would logistically do it, but do like a dual broadcast where it would be me and the Altoona guy, and we would just both be calling the game at the same time, and you know there'd be a lot of logistics of how you send it back to the studio and all that, but that's something we'd like to do at some point.
That'd be really cool.
That would be cool. So can John and I come and call a game, call an inning with you sometime?
I'll throw anybody on the air.
Yes. Yes! That's my dream!
Start moonlighting as a baseball caller?
No, I don't know if I'd go that far. You know, I would love to do that, although watching Greg work, it's like, I don't know if I want to do
I just want to be a wallflower. Like, you can do it, and I'll just come there and watch, because I think it'd be a sight to see.
Let's before we get into the game stuff, let's clarify that Greg's job isn't just calling games. I mean, that's the fun part, right?
Right. It really is. That's the break in my day.
Yeah, to walk us through a game day from beginning to end, what do you do?
We get there 9 o'clock in the morning on a game day, and you know I do sales in the off season, so if I have client stuff I have to deal with that day, and you never know when a certain client is going to need something, and you have some clients that are, you know, that need a lot more attention than others. Some are just, hey, here's what we're doing, but others you have different events throughout the season. So if it's a day where I have a client that's coming out that night and they're entertaining 25 people, I got to make sure everything's good with that. So that's, you know, I mean, that's first and foremost what you kind of focus on with your day. I handle our website. I handle our game notes that you see in the press box. It's really, you know, it's every little odds and ends type things. I oversee all of our club communications. So if it's a day where we're trying to heavily promote like pink jersey giveaway or pink jersey night, and you know, it's making phone calls to the media in the morning. Hey, you guys need to be out here to do a story for your noon show. You know, that's a lot of my day is doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's some days you're working nonstop until the game, and on other days it's quieter than others. You know, a random Wednesday in April, you're not going to be as busy as a Friday in July.
Right. And you're also, I've, you know, you're running around taking care of little emergencies around the park, and
you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Never.
Putting out fires.
And Greg Coleman, too. What's his title? Is it president
He's
or GM?
The team president.
Team president Greg Coleman is also, you know, before a game, you'll see these guys running around like crazy. Greg with his little spray bottle and rag, wiping off all the all the surfaces in the park.
We make fun of him behind his back for that all the time.
great guy. We should have him on the podcast later.
Absolutely.
He'll talk.
He's got some stories.
Yeah. He's a great guy, too. But yeah, I mean, I guess my point is, you know, this radio announcing gig is just a really small part of what you do as media relations. You're also the guy who deals with the player relations and the team relations,
Yeah, I do all
right?
that stuff. I mean, you know, about 2 years ago, Coleman promoted myself and another guy, Mark Perlo, to assistant GM level. And so Mark kind of oversees all the sales aspects of everything we do, and I'm overseeing all the communications aspects. And that's media relations, public relations, entertainment, the team. All kind of falls under my umbrella. So like I said, there's some days where it's, you know, it's light, and then there's other days where 10 players need something. You know, we had a guy this year, his mom was flying in from Venezuela, so I had to coordinate sending someone to the airport because she was flying in. Of course, she was flying in during our game, not in the morning. So we had to send somebody to the airport to pick up his mom, who didn't speak any English, get her to the ballpark, and then find a way to get, after the homestand, to get her to Akron, Ohio, where we were going to be at the back end of a road trip, and make sure his car was there as well. So right. we had cars going everywhere, and you never know what's gonna happen.
Right.
And of course, I get a text message at 2 o'clock. Hey, Cabrera needs to talk to you about something. Okay, well, it's game day. What's going on? He just needs to talk to you. So you go down there, and you get this sprung on you at 4 o'clock, and it's like, all right, I guess we have some coordinating to do.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of curveballs that you get a lot of times.
Right. So you get in at 9 in the morning. This is for a 7 o'clock game.
Mm-hmm.
You roll into the booth 5 minutes beforehand. You call the game. Game gets out at 10 o'clock, reasonable time. It's about 3 hours.
I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, and then you still have work to do after that.
Yeah. Taking box scores to the clubhouse, updating the team website, getting the recap out to the media.
Yeah.
It never ends. And, you know, most nights I'll get out of the ballpark 11 midnight. Depends if we sit around and have a few beers to unwind afterwards.
Yeah, or, you know,
it's just one of those things later, where, you know, I joke around with people. It's like, you know, a nice beer at the end of the day is a lot of times what you need because you just need to unwind.
Yeah.
After, I mean, it's a lot of times it's high stress from the minute you get there until the minute you leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer in the end of the workday beer. I'm a firm believer in shower beer as well as part of that end of the workday. You come home, hop in the shower, take the beer with you. It's perfect.
Now, you're also on all the road trips, right? Mm-hmm. But that's an easier schedule, right? There's not as much stuff
to do at home. It's not as time-consuming. No. I mean, look, you're traveling from city to city. It could be anywhere from 2 hours to Akron to 12 hours to Maine.
Yeah.
So that is...
On a bus,
yeah. My back hates me.
Yeah.
Buses and hotels the last 11 years have not been kind to my lower back. But yeah, we do that. You know, that's one of those where you'll get your morning to yourself for a night game. I mean, I'll hop on the team bus at 10 a.m. to go to the gym. And then we usually go to the ballpark around 2. And then whenever the game's done, you know, you wrap up, and you head back to the hotel and do it all again the next day.
Yeah. And how many games in the AA season?
142 total.
142 games. So
71-71.
Yeah, it's from April to September, essentially. Yep. You've got this schedule. Mm-hmm. 12-14-hour days pretty much every day.
Pretty much.
On the road and buses.
It sounds glamorous. You're selling me on it.
I know. Who wouldn't want this job?
Yeah, we'll talk to us about that. What do you like about the job?
It's something new every day. That's the easiest way to say. I mean, you never know what you're going to get.
You seem like a problem solver, too. You seem like you enjoy solving problems, like the coordinating side of it. You know what I mean?
You know,
like, even though it's like
it depends
ass,
how big the problem it is. Yeah, I mean, there are days where I just want to yell and scream, and, you know, and that's happened. I pulled a new one this year. I got really upset and threw a chair, and I've never done that in my career. It was one of those where the day was so frustrating and everything boiled over, and then that one thing just sent me over the edge, and I found a folding chair and just tossed it down the hallway.
Awesome.
I don't usually lose my cool like that, but I mean, that's... You just it's those things that sometimes those things build and build it's the high stress of it. You know, the stress is fun though too, trying to work through all the different things you have to work with. And you know, we didn't even talk about, you know, rain issues.
Right.
Communicating to Joe Fan about yes, we are going to play even though it's raining at 10 a.m. in the morning.
Yep.
Yeah.
People, you know, it cracks me up that baseball has been in Erie, gosh, for 100 years. And you know, I mean Ainsworth Field, I'm assuming they had a tarp there, but heck, since 1995 Jarrett Park has had a tarped field. It's a professional field that drains well, and it's not just Erie, it's everywhere, but people can't grasp that it's not little Jimmy's little league field.
Yeah,
that, you know, it's gonna rain and then in 2 days we still can't play,
right?
And we'll get phone calls on Saturday, hey, are you guys gonna be able to play on Monday with, you know, all this rain's coming through? Well, yeah, we have a field, it's tarped, and,
right,
you know, people will argue with you on the phone, you're not gonna play this game tonight, you're not, there's no way. Or the popular one is, well, it's raining in Meadville. We get more calls in our office that says, oh, it's pouring here in Meadville. And my token response to that is, well, it's a good thing we didn't build the stadium in Meadville.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, people like can't comprehend weather is different in other places. You know?
Right.
I mean, it'll be, you know, I'm in Fairview and it's pouring here. I mean, we're looking around. It's sunny here.
Yeah.
So people, you know, that's tough to try and you know, social media has helped that out a lot with website, and you can let fans know. But yeah, it never fails.
That's awesome. That's hilarious. What about calling the game? I mean, that's kind of why you're doing this, mm-hmm. right? That for that opportunity.
That's how I got into it. And, you know, the goal is the major leagues. So hopefully someday.
What made you want to be a broadcaster?
I don't know. I do not know. I guess it was ninth grade in high school. My English teacher happened to also run the high school TV station, and she goes, "Ah, you have a good voice. You should do this TV thing with us." I'm like, nah, not going to do that. And then the next year I was doing the sports on the daily television show in school and called a few games in high school. I went to college and I was like, all right, I'm going to go and I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be the Craig Smiley guy. I'm going to be on the local sports. And when I got there, the they had a nice television station at Bowling Green. And if you weren't an upperclassman, you weren't getting on TV. And I could get on right away doing the sports talk radio and calling games. We one of the things with our Carlos station, we did the most, I think they still are, they call the most games of any college station in the nation. And we were flagship for women's basketball, hockey. We did every football game. So there were so many opportunities and so few people to get on air that I got on right away.
Nice.
And I kind of said, well, the heck with this TV thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was frustrating because I would see some of the slack jaws they would put on TV. And I'm like, okay, I'm better than him. I'm better than him. And I'm better than that girl who's reporting. But they're going to get that opportunity. And I said, the heck with it. I'm going to go and focus on calling games. And it worked out.
When you were younger, did you listen to a lot of games? I mean, was that?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I you know, I was that idiot that would play Tecmo Bowl and drive my friends crazy by, you know, calling, hey, Dan Marino drops back to pass, and there's Mark Clayton, touchdown Dolphins. That was me.
Sitting, Bo Jackson.
Yes, there's Bo Jackson, and he's gone. That was me when I was younger. So I guess it was always kind of in me, and then that just kind of gave me an opportunity to get it out of me in high school and college.
That's awesome.
How'd you get into minor league calling?
Dumb luck. I was 16, and we had a minor league team coming into town. And I lived in Warren, Ohio, and then in Niles, Ohio was the Mahoning Valley Scrappers, brand new team, 1999. Got a job in the concession stand and did that for a year, and then they liked me. And then the second year, I was, I guess, ambitious enough where I was running one of the concession stands. So I did that for a few years, and I went to the GM. Had to be before my sophomore year of college. I said, hey, listen, my parents are pushing me. I got to get an internship. I want to be here with you guys, but I don't know what you can offer, if there's even anything to offer me. But, you know, you've got me for the next couple of years if you want me. And he goes, well, what are you going to school for? I said, well, broadcasting. He goes, well, I don't know what our broadcast situation is going to be like, but I'll keep you in mind. And I'm thinking to myself, what? Well, just so happens he didn't like his broadcaster and called me in January and goes, hey, how do you want to be? Would you like to be my broadcaster next season? Yes. And I had a college professor who was kind of giving me a hard time. Well, you can't take that job. I said, well, what do you mean I can't take the job? It's on air time. It's 76 games of calling baseball. It's what I want to do. And, well, if you have to miss school, you just can't do it. I said, well, I'm taking this job.
Yeah.
And I did. Did that for 3 years. Big disappointment when I didn't get a full-time job with them. I mean, small market, single-A, short-season club. They weren't going to hire full-time broadcasters, so I kind of just didn't work out there. And then Erie had an opening. And at the time, the teams were mutually owned or had just kind of broken away from being mutually owned, but a lot of people had worked in both clubs and had some connections and actually ran into a guy that worked up here at a wedding of the GM who wasn't hiring me down in Mahoning Valley. And so we connected there, and he was like, well, you know, I don't know what our situation is, but send a resume up. And I'm like, all right. Then in March of 06, got hired here, and I've been doing something right. They've kept me around ever since then.
Yeah.
I never would have thought I would have been in Erie that long, but, you know, it's – I got to the AA level at such a young age that I'm still not that old for being in AA.
Right.
You know, I always say, you're too good for this market. And I said, well, no, it's – you got to look at it as – levels of baseball. You know, I'm not going to go take a AAA job that's seasonal, that's not paying me the kind of money I'm making here. You know,
right.
I've established myself in a marketplace. I have, you know, kind of branched out a bit and gone in the management route. And so I have, you know, that working for me as well. So as long as they keep giving me the bucks, that's.
You heard that, Coleman?
Yes.
So it's year round for working with the Seal Wolves. So what do you do in the off season then?
Like I said, right now we're doing budget stuff for next year, budgeting. Then it starts once the budget gets approved. Then it's, you know, for the baseball side of things, getting uniforms together, getting you know, all the reorders. Did you know Wade Gaynor's jersey is covered in pine tar, so I have to replace that jersey.
Nice.
You know, it's just sorting through all that stuff. Then we start in our sales, and I do a lot of our myself, Coleman, and Mark Perlow handle our corporate sales. So I'm involved with that aspect of it. And it's marketing, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just everything that gets, you know, we started planning for 2014. I think we got our first draft of the schedule in the first week of May of this past season. So, I mean, planning starts then for the following year.
Right.
And so it's really never a dull moment because you're already planning so far ahead.
Right, right, right.
And then so that's really now it's just implementing those plans.
That's awesome.
And you're I mean, this is the trajectory of this job is similar to that of a baseball player's, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you're shooting for the big leagues as well.
Absolutely. You know, if it happens, that's great. If not, I have established myself as a minor league broadcaster and also on a manager side. I mean, you know, if the broadcasting never works out, it'd be fun to run my own team someday. I mean, would be, you know, be a lot more money than I'm making now. So it would make it even better. But, you know, I've kind of given myself a couple different paths, and that's something that I didn't have when I first got into the business, and I've, you know, made my connections, and I've done what I've needed to do to get to this point and, you know, and hopefully forward.
Well, I'm hoping to get there. It'd be pretty cool to have done a podcast with a major absolutely. Broadcaster. Woohoo! Tell us about some of the fun stuff that you do day to day that's related to baseball. Like part of your job on the road is you talk with the players on the bus, you hang out mm-hmm. with them, you get stories to tell on air. And is that right? That kind of thing?
Absolutely. I mean, you'll never know. You know, our trainer and I were together for the last 8 years, and I think he's actually going to be promoted to Toledo next season. But he and I kind of hung around together on the road, and you know, I was in the clubhouse in the training room all the time, and you know, just talking to guys. And I'm in the fantasy football league with a bunch of our players, and so you know, you forge those relationships. And it's a little tougher now because I'm getting older, and they are, you know, still in that 22 to 25 range. So yeah. I'm getting a little older. So I think while you, in age, you gain more respect from them, you kind of lose a little bit of the personal connection because they mm-hmm. connect a lot more when you're their age. So it's, you know, that it's a little more difficult as I get older, but then, like I said, the more respect you command, the more they're willing to help you out in doing interviews or doing appearances and things like that.
Right.
Yeah. What's your routine on the road? I mean, I remember something about a cooler on the bus.
I actually, a couple of years ago, it was myself, our trainer and strength coach decided that we were going to pocket our per diems every day and pack coolers for the road to save money. And I'm happy to report I've put a couple grand in the bank the last few years because I've saved meal money by just bringing healthier. I mean, because I go to the gym every day on the road, and so it's like, well, why go to the gym and then go eat out?
Right. Know, at
at some of our hotels, there's not a whole lot of options around to go eat at good places.
Yeah.
You know, Bowie's great. There's a Whole Foods right next to the hotel.
Oh, that's
and there's
cool.
a couple, you know, healthy places. But, I mean, for the most part, you're not finding those where we stay.
And so,
that's the old cooler routine. A lot of our players do that, too, where they'll just bring coolers for the road trips and have, you know, I eat at the ballpark for my dinner. But then, you know, during the day, if you want a turkey sandwich, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually not a bad spread at the park in the media room. It's
ours is pretty good.
It is pretty great.
Yeah, we've done a nice job with that. Some of the parks it's not as good, but I'd say Binghamton's pretty brutal. They'll throw out a couple Pizza Hut pizzas, and that's about it. But Erie one's pretty solid.
Although I hear people complaining about it all the time in the media room. Should I rat them out? Or
absolutely rat them out. It always boggles my mind how people complain about free food. If I don't, you know, we're on the road, and I think the press spread is terrible, I'll just go to the concession stand and buy something I want. But I mean, you put something out there and people, you know, a couple people don't like it, they're gonna let you know about it. I'm like, it's free food.
I know,
right? Yeah.
I heard a couple of complaints, but I guess if you're at the park every night, you know, the coverage that I've done is, you know, I go a couple times a season, so whatever I get is it's icing on the cake, right? I don't know, do you have I have a gazillion questions. They're not popping in my mind right now.
No, they're not popping up. So, I mean, how old were you when you first started working here in Erie?
23.
And how old are you now?
I actually turned 31 today.
Oh, hey.
Is your birthday?
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Happy Thanks. Birthday. Woohoo.
Yeah, so.
This is the perfect gift.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, you're not necessarily, you know, you're not really from here. So, what do you think of Erie? Do you like it here?
I'm still here.
Right. Well, yeah. But I mean,
that's a loaded question, man.
The job's here, though. You know what I mean? But
I'll go anywhere for the job. That's kind of all I am. I mean, I enjoy living here. You know, cost of living is not expensive for me. I mean, I have an upper level of a house, and I live with my dog, and, you know, I have a good time.
Oh, what kind of dog do you have?
I have a Jack Russell.
Oh, nice. Awesome. So, those are smart dogs.
Yes, very much.
teach a lot of tricks.
She does a lot of tricks. Yeah. And she sleeps a lot, which is, she's a mix with some kind of hound, and she'll be, because a lot of times Jack Russell's are real animated.
Yeah, yeah.
She does that for about 10 minutes when I get home, and then she sleeps.
Good.
And I'm like, perfect apartment dog. So don't worry about her.
That's hilarious.
No, I enjoy living and working here. I mean, you know, we work in downtown, so you see a lot.
Right.
And I don't think that's necessarily representative of the people of Erie, what we see walking always up and down the streets of downtown. Because, you know, like, look, with any downtown, you're going to see
But
what you see out there. But, I mean, for the most part, you know, I guess my biggest regret of living here is I haven't been able to take advantage of things like the lake and the beaches. Because
Yeah, well, that's just a funny thing. But I think most people here who live here don't take advantage of those things because you forget about it. Yeah, because you're working.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Especially, like, you know, for our... I know, like, my parents, my dad worked at GE forever, and, like, he rarely went to the beaches. Only, like, one of my, like, aunts and uncles had, like, the family picnic, so we ever make it down. And even myself, currently, like, I'm so focused with working on stuff all the time, and I'm always trying to, like, figure out what I want to be pursuing and developing and working on that I never made it down to the beach this summer.
Really?
Never, not once.
I guess I have 9-year-olds, so I'm there all the
time. Yeah, it's different, right? Yeah. And, but the thing, what you're saying about downtown is interesting, because I feel like, there's all this talk about trying to develop downtown and try and, like, restore it to some greater glory. But it's like there's so much things that need to, like, change for that to happen, right? It's just, like, I don't know what, like there's, like, no surefire thing to do.
I think that's with any downtown, though. I mean, you know, you remember years ago, Cleveland was a pit.
Right.
And, you know, in the heyday of the Indians and then later on with the Cavs, I mean, that whole area around the Q and Jacobs Field was just buzzing. And, you know, I think that with the new arena renovations, hopefully some ballpark renovations on the horizon at some point, you know, you've seen more businesses coming in. I just saw the other day that is it Lavery Brewing?
They're
opening up a little gastro pub. I mean, there's places to go. There's places like that are bringing younger people into downtown, and I think that's, you know, you're getting your business professionals hanging out more down there.
Yeah, but I mean, they do stuff like that, but then I get confused by, like, the condos. You know,
well, I don't think anybody can figure out those. I
mean, right. Just like
I finally figured out how to unsubscribe from those emails that they keep sending me. Hey, for only $175,000. Oh, thanks. I'll pass.
But I was there was a housing crash like not so long ago, right?
That I don't understand that plan per se. But but as far as small businesses go, I think they've made it attractive to bring in smaller businesses downtown. And, you know, I guess 5 years ago, I was more on the lines of trying to go to the college bars. But, you know, now it's nice to go. You know, the one I love is Jekyll and Hyde's right by the ballpark.
Yeah, that's a great park. I love that place.
I like going to that place. It's within walking distance of work, and you can try it.
The food's great.
Food is different beers. I mean, that's places like that are going to bring people into downtown. And,
right.
You know, I think the sports teams play a huge role in the downtown. You know,
Jerry, that park is gorgeous. You know what I mean? Like, every time I go there, I'm always reminded about, this is a really nice park. Like, holy shit.
And the thing is that it's 20 years old now.
Yeah, I know.
And it's going to need work. And, you know, it's logistical things that Joe fan's not going to notice when they go in there. And one of the things, actually, that they're improving, if everything goes through, we're going to get a new sound system next year.
Oh, nice.
We had a situation where we had speakers blowing in certain parts of the ballpark. You couldn't even hear what was being played over the sound system. So that was one of the big projects that we talked to the convention authority about, going into next year. It's a 20-year-old ballpark that's going to need, you know, I don't think we're going to get the $47 million that the arena got, but I think in time they're going to need to start, because right now we are falling behind the times with ballparks.
Right. I mean, how old was the arena before they dumped all that money?
It was 30 years,
I think. Yeah. I mean, that definitely needed a facelift.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. I mean, it was a hole before they put all that money into it. And, you know, I went in the other day and I said, well, if they would have spent another $20 million, they could have done this, and this.
Right.
But, I mean, I'm not that guy who gets to make that decision.
Make those calls,
But
not to get into Erie politics, but that's kind of par for the course, so they'll shortchange the project, you know, to be penny-pinching and not think of the long-term.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's what, you know, decisions. For the long-term vitality of Erie baseball, you know, the problem is people don't see other ballparks in the minor leagues and what they have become. I think a lot of the frame of reference is, well, Ainsworth Field was this, and now we have this.
Yeah,
right.
Well, this has now become, you know, 20 years old in a hurry. And so I think, you know, long term, they're going to need to pump some money into that facility, and hopefully it happens, because it is a good, it's a good spot. It's got its intricacies.
Yeah.
It has logistical challenges from working there, because we don't have a lot of space to do things with. But you know, you have a nice new arena next door, and hopefully that, you know, now people will say, when we need to do this to the ballpark as well.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's, I think they built the park for about $8 or $9 million, and now you're seeing minor league parks built for $50 million.
Yeah. What about Portland? Is the Sea Dogs Park?
That's not a great stadium.
It's not? Okay.
No. They have more suites than we do,
yeah,
which is nicer, but their general ballpark, other than the Green Monster they've got up there, doesn't offer a whole lot.
What's the best in the league?
Best in the league, probably ballpark-wise, Altoona is by far the best.
Really?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
And it's road you trip. Wouldn't think.
Yeah, let's do it.
Oh, it's a beautiful facility. It's too big for Altoona is really what it is, because they have a hard time filling it now.
Sure.
I mean, back in their heyday, they were putting 9,000-10,000 people in, but you know, Altoona's got, I think their population is like 45,000. So you know, they've struggled a bit in recent years to fill that park. But that's a beautiful facility. Akron is an awesome facility, and those are the two of the newest ones in the league. New Hampshire's got a nice one that's fairly new. I think that was 04 on theirs.
Too far for us on that.
Yeah, that's a haul.
Yeah.
Portland's by far the best city, but the ballpark's not. Mm-hmm. Not real fun.
What city is New Hampshire?
Manchester.
Manchester, okay.
So you said that the Altoona has been able to pack their seats, but I mean, isn't that like a sort of a worry here? I mean, how many years in a row now we've consecutively said that our census has gone down?
Oh, the whole city? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, I mean, have you guys like kept the stadium full for the past few seasons, or what's your numbers been like?
I think we had 19 sellouts this last year.
Okay.
So I think that's right. I think we target 20 sellout dates, somewhere in that 20 to 25 range. You know, it's the typical minor league where you're struggling in April and May,
right?
And then June, July, and August you get great crowds. You know, obviously we have our niche with Buck Night. We try and target our weekends with fireworks.
Thank you guys for doing that, by the way. Like, I mean, because like, remember the, because was it like a year ago Tuesday when we didn't have the 4th of July fireworks? Oh, yeah, and like, yeah, you guys were the only people kind of doing fireworks in Waldemere, like the only place you could go see fireworks in the summer. And that's like a big deal, because it's like a big summer
it
thing,
is.
You know, it's fireworks.
It absolutely is. I wish more people would look at it that way.
Right. I value it. I mean, I'm always thankful when I can like, even because I can sometimes see them from here. Mm-hmm. I can just like walk out on 6th Street and look down towards the field and you can see them. It's like, yeah, oh, cool. That's right. Someone knows it's goddamn summer. Thank you.
It's, you know, we try and do, and I'm trying to get Coleman to do more fireworks shows next year, because I think it adds so much to what we do.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's, you know, I think in my mind, and I don't know if it's the general thought in minor league baseball, but in my mind, the crappy, you know, water bottle giveaway that, you know, it used to be when I first got into the business, hey, we're going to do, if we have 30 home games, we're going to do 28 giveaway days. And I think that the trend has gone away from, oh, here's a pencil, come out to the game, to more of experiential,
right,
type things,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
fireworks.
Yeah.
And we even took it a step further. Last year, we started selling these little glow wands, mm-hmm, type, mm-hmm, things. And so we were like, well, we're not selling enough of these. So what can we do to turn this into an experience? Well, now if you buy your glow wand, you get to go, you know, they light up and sparkle and do all kinds of crap. I don't know. We have like glasses ones now that people can. Basically, if you buy any light up toy, you get to go on the field during fireworks.
Oh, nice.
And we limit it to the first, you know, 150 people that buy something. And it's pretty cool. You see all these kids out there with their light wands waving it as the fireworks are going off. And it's just trying to build,
yeah,
more experience like that. You know, the kid stampede is another one that,
yeah,
we were able,
yeah,
to bring back.
That's hilarious.
But, you know, in lieu of not having that the one year, we did Kids Run the Bases every night. And so now we've brought back the stampede because we can,
yeah,
because the construction's done. And we also give people the chance to be on the field after every game. Every,
right,
kid can go onto the field. So it's,
catch.
And playing catch on Sundays.
Yeah.
That's like a big deal, too. Because like, I remember as a kid, like, getting on the field is,
yeah,
like this like,
yeah,
auspicious,
so,
occasion. Like, you're not supposed to be here. It's,
you know,
sacred ground.
We lose, yeah, sight of it working,
yeah,
working in it. You know, and I guess, you know, you see people's faces light up when they get on the field. It's like, to me, it's just open the gate and walk out there.
Right.
You know, but now it's like, oh, well, you got to look at it from that kid's point of view. Like, wow, this is pretty cool. I'm on the field.
Right. Cause, yeah, like the one day they might want to be like, I want to pitch on this field.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's awesome.
They don't let us on the infield, unfortunately.
Yeah. Right.
on the mound. Right. That'd be hilarious. Let's talk about baseball for a second. Let's talk about the season of the Seawolves. I mean, it was pretty interesting, right? They had a successful season.
Yeah, we did. First playoff appearance since 2007, so that was fun.
And this isn't a team that you would – I mean, I guess it's – the way I would call it is the sum was greater than the parts, right? Like
there chemistry. It was a lot of chemistry. It was a lot of playing together. It wasn't a whole lot of you're going to look at this guy and say, he's a big leaguer.
Right.
You know, we had, I think from last year's club, we had more guys in the big leagues already, and we had one guy from this year's team, and he wasn't even there in the second half of the year. Hernan Perez, who was just the uber prospect that rose quickly to the big leagues. And so, yeah, it was a season where there wasn't a whole lot of those blue chip guys. But they played well together, and they liked each other, and they played hard every night, and it just something clicked. You know, I think at the end, we just couldn't hit in the playoffs, and that's what it boiled down to.
Yeah, it's like the flaws of the team sort of caught up with it. And
it did, and you know, the thing is, we had hit Harrisburg pretty well during the season, and their pitchers just – they had probably four of their five starters on the team are going to be in the big leagues. And so we just ran into a team that got hot at the right time, and then they ran into a team in the championship series that was even hotter in Trenton, and they got swept.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of who gets hot at the end, and it was not us this year. But it was fun. It was fun getting into the playoffs, and you know that's an experience that doesn't come around very often. Like I said, it was the first time since 07 for us.
Yeah.
So it was nice to kind of crash that party and get in.
Yeah. Hernan Perez, what makes him so good?
He's got that it factor. You know, a lot of times you don't see the Latin American guys being the leaders in the clubhouse, and he was a guy that was that clubhouse leader when he was here. And you know, he came to play every day, and he was just a really talented, good kid. And I think he's going to be, you know, he's the second baseman of the future for the Tigers, if you ask me, because he could hit a little bit, he could field.
Yeah.
He does the intangibles, and he's got the heart, and that's a big piece of it.
Is he going to hit enough to play? I mean, I could see him, especially with Iglesias at short for the long term, are they going to settle for a you know, Perez's bat?
I don't know. I mean, I think he's going to have to hit for a little more pop.
Yeah.
But he's still pretty young, though, too. I mean, he's... You know, that's a pretty big jump.
Like 21? Wasn't he or 22?
Suarez was 21. I can't remember how old Perez was now.
Eugenio Suarez.
Eugenio,
sorry.
Yes.
Shortstop.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fun kid to watch at short.
Because on I remember the preseason lists, he was above Perez.
Yes. Yeah, he was. He and Dixon Machado were both above Hernan, I believe.
Yeah.
But Hernan he came out and had a great year and is in the big leagues now and gets to experience Tigers winning the division. So he actually got called up for two games last year and got a World Series ring out of it, or a AL Championship ring out of it.
Nice.
Anybody that plays at least one game in the big leagues gets a ring.
That's cool.
When they came and brought the AL Championship rings in this year, he got a ring.
Any other guys on the team you think will hit the bigs?
I think James McCann's got a shot.
That's a catcher, right?
Yeah.
Futures game he played. Wasn't he in the Futures game? Starting catcher?
Backup catcher in the Futures game.
Okay.
I think he had two at-bats in that game.
That's the showcase event for the minor leagues, right?
Yeah, that's kind of
it's all-star time, isn't it?
I think a week before the actual major league all-star game.
Right.
But yeah,
it's not just one level. It's from all the whole
minor leagues.
Yeah.
But he's a guy that has a shot. I'd say Daniel Fields has some tools. He just needs to put those tools together.
Yeah.
I think he's got a shot at making
and a much improved season this year too. We should.
Yeah, you know, he cut down on the strikeouts. He just, you know, I had a scout tell me just it doesn't seem like he's always into it. And I said, you know, I just don't know if he's just that quick that he doesn't look like he's trying as hard every time. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I just think he needs to focus on more of the little things because the talent is there and that talent can get him to the next level. And when you see him really turn it on, the kid's quicker than heck.
Yeah.
But you know, I just think he needs to get more of the intangibles that you saw in a guy like Perez.
Right.
You know, I'm not gonna say Daniel Fields doesn't have heart because that's not true. And his dad played in the big league, so he knows what he needs to do to get there.
Yep.
But he just needs to work on more of the little things that's going to get him to that next level.
Yeah. I remember seeing him struggle against same side pitching, especially,
especially late in the year, breaking balls to the other batter's box he was chasing after.
Yeah. I remember seeing him strike out a couple times in big situations. But
Collins is kind of a wild card in the outfield.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you about him.
He's got some power. he's decent in the outfield, has a great arm. He's just going to have to hit for average. If he can Did you see what
Jason Parks wrote about him in Baseball Perspectives? No, he said he had absolutely no baseball sense.
Collins is a little hard-headed, so yeah. I can see why that would be. But I don't know if he doesn't have
– something about no insight. I wish I could get the quote, but it was – you know, Parks is kind of a funny guy. You know, he at least tries to be. And it was a good quote. Like, he's got no instincts or, you know, like he has – you know, you wouldn't find him if you – you know, if they hit him in the face or something like that. But he had – I remember he had at least 1 week where he was
– oh, God. He had 7 homers in 6 games.
Yes.
In May, I think it was.
So he's real streaky. I mean, he
was a
really
very streaky hitter. But when he focuses on just see the ball, hit the ball, instead of trying to swing out of his shoes every time, he's much better. It cracks me up when you bring it, like the Baseball Perspective. I mean, I see these. I actually got an email from someone at Baseball America once saying, hey, you know, we think that this guy's got the best changeup in the league, but, you know, the coaches voted this guy has the best changeup in the league. What did you see? And I'm like, the damn broadcaster. You shouldn't be asking me what I think about such and such changeup. And that's why I don't put a whole lot of stock into what they say a lot of times.
Yeah.
I put stock into what the scouts say because I talk to them a lot.
Right.
And you know, so you'll never hear me quoting Baseball America on the air because I just don't – my personal view is I just don't believe in what they have to say. I think a lot of it is we're going to do this because we want to sell extra books and extra magazines.
Yeah. Now, the scouts are always at the games, right? I mean, they're usually sitting right behind home plate. I've tried to talk to some in the past, but they're usually
– very guarded.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are. It took me a while to get a few of them to warm up to me, but, I mean, I have some relationships with a few of them. So it's – that's fun because you can bounce things off of them.
Yeah. I would love to
– it's kind of – it's good because it's that unspoken code in baseball where – hey, if they tell you something, you know not to open your mouth and say it to anybody else.
Right.
And that's why I think that once you kind of prove that, I don't know why that is. I just think it's such a close-knit – because they don't want me coming on your podcast telling you what the guy from the Cincinnati Reds thought about
so-and-so.
But you could quote an anonymous source or something. Is that still breaking the code? Or?
That's – I think a lot of times you'll get away with that. You'll see – Tim Kirkson, who knows everybody, will say, you know, I talked to an American League scout today, and he told me. So that's how they get away with it. And you can, you know, that's how you get around it. But, yeah, you never want to quote them per se because that's – you never know when it's going to come back.
Yeah, definitely not. But also, I guess that's what they do for a living. It's that information they hold and asking it for free, I guess, is
– yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's like asking a writer to add content to a website for nothing.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah, and yeah, I don't go to the park very often, but I do try to talk to those guys, and they're usually, like you said, very guarded. It's interesting. Go down behind the home plate and see the players, right? The players go down. They're always charting
two every night.
Yeah.
Charting pitches for the
– and they're much more open to talking. And
stuff. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Because they get bored up there, especially when the other team's – when their team is hitting, they don't have to chart the other team's pitchers, so they just sit there and BS.
Yeah. What about Chris Krohn? What's your take on him?
Easy to work with. By far the easiest manager I've ever had to work with. I don't think the fans like him a lot of times because he doesn't do the conventional things that they want him to do. It was very funny. Our pitching coach, Jaime Garcia, came up to me towards the end of the year, and he goes, Crony's been here how long? It's 3 years. And he goes, you think some of these fans would realize that he just isn't going to bunt? And I'm like, I have to field that question all the time. And why doesn't he bunt? Why doesn't he bunt? Well, the guy doesn't believe in giving extra outs. Yeah. And the Tigers, you know, people don't want to hear it. Well, the Tigers don't want them to.
Right.
Well, he should just say the heck with the Tigers and he should bunt them over because it's the right move.
Right.
Well, long gone are the days of get him on, bunt him over kind of baseball. Yes, yeah. You don't see that a whole lot anymore. You know, and you know, Redding led the league in sacrifice bunts, and they were one of the worst teams in the league. Right. So the stats don't correlate necessarily with scoring more runs that way. And I think one of his philosophies has always been that. But it's funny because, you know, we'll get a guy on first base late in a ball game, and he'll let a guy swing away. And you know, I can hear people over the crowd like, what are you doing, Krohn? Why aren't you? I'm like, guys, come on. But yeah,
I'm firmly in that school as well. You know, the anti-sacrifice bunt. Let me ask you about sort of the advanced statistics stuff that's going on in baseball today. Do you read any of those sites, the Prospectus or FanGraphs, or dabble in advanced metrics or anything, the WAR and all that stuff?
to me, that's all fun stuff to talk about. But I don't – you know what? Just like last year with Cabrera versus Trout.
Well, yeah.
Trout supposedly had the better saber whatever metric stuff. And I'm like, eh, that's great. But you know what? Cabrera's going to the playoffs and that he won the Triple Crown. To me, it's more about numbers than it is about all the saber BS that's out there. And that's just my personal, you know, stuff. I don't talk about WHIP on the air. I don't talk about a lot of those new age fantasy stats. I want to know, you know, strikeouts to walks. I want to know the guts of what this guy's going to bring to the table. I want to know what he's hitting with runners in scoring position in two outs. That's going to tell me a heck of a lot more than some crazy stat.
Huh, that's interesting. I mean, I would respectfully disagree. We could have a nice conversation about it. But I feel like, you know, like the advanced metrics say with sacrifice bunts, I mean, that's one of the things that it points out is that there are wasted outs, essentially. Mm-hmm. The advantage you get from knocking a runner over another base is more than lost an out that you've created on the play, right? So there are other things, and I think to me the interesting thing about the triple the most valuable player debate last year was that people kept citing the Triple Crown, right? It was statistics, right? They say, well, he was best in runs batted in and batting average and home runs. And of those three, probably only homers is really indicative of value, you know. But they're all fantasy stats. I think that's why people are attracted to it. You know, Trout's contributions on the field are more general and harder to count and harder to measure and harder to put in a stat that you would play a fantasy league team on. And to me, I see that as an advanced stats guy. It's like old school baseball. The guy can run and field and Cabrera can't, you know, he's a great hitter. I don't think anyone questions that he was the best hitter by far last year and this year, but we're sort of overlooking what makes a player great, you know, like the whole game, you have to play both sides, you know, all nine innings. So to me, it's
an interesting argument.
Absolutely.
Let's get in it.
I challenge you. Let me ask you though, being involved in the Tigers organization, do you feel like some sort of institutional bias when you compare someone like Cabrera with Trout? I mean, do you go for your guy?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who cuts the check, right?
That's right.
Come on.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we always root for our, you know, it was weird because when I was working for an Indians affiliate, I was, you know, one of the biggest cheerleaders for the Indians.
Yeah.
You know, now that I'm working in a Tigers affiliate, I'm a huge Tiger fan right now. It's, you know, it's fun to root for those guys that you see here and now that are playing in the big leagues. And, you know.
Yeah, you're much more connected to them. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
You've seen them here and now they're there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you always see the personnel coming through. You know, Dave Dombrowski comes through town and he remembers who you are.
Yeah.
You know, and Al Avila who comes in and, you know, we see him and then I see him getting champagne dumped on his head the other night.
Yeah.
You know, that's – you make those personal connections and you have a good working relationship with all those folks when they're in town here. You know, one of the cool things that Dave has is that everybody in the organization needs to come in at least once to each of the affiliates. So if you're anybody who's anybody with the Tigers, you're coming into Erie at least one time a year from Dombrowski to Avila to all their major scouts. I mean, everybody comes in at least one time to see the club and I think that's great. Because it gives the front office a chance to talk to those people, and it gives them a chance to see who's on the field.
That's cool. I just want to go back to the advanced stats for just a second and talk about runners in scoring position.
Can't give it up. He can't give it up.
But it has to do with minor league baseball. Like one of the arguments that people use about in advanced metrics about clutch hitting is that it doesn't exist in the major league level. That if you look at a guy's career over entire course, you'll see it stabilize, you know, their performance stabilize with their career numbers over the course of the career, whatever, the larger sample, blah, blah, blah. And one of the arguments for that is by the time they get to the major leagues, they've already undergone so many pressure situations that all the folks that don't perform well under pressure are sort of winnowed out by the process of getting to the big leagues. So if you make it to the bigs, you're a clutch hitter, right? Do you see? I mean, in minor leagues, do you see that? Are there guys that freeze at the plate in late inning situations? Can you see it? Can you see some guys better under pressure than others?
You can, but
Is it body language? Do you see that, or is it just performance?
I mean, you could tell a lot by body language.
Because so much of his luck, right? I mean, you could come up with two outs and a runner in score position. He hit a line drive scorcher at the second baseman, right?
I mean, I can't tell you how many times you're in a close game, you get a guy on third and the ninth inning, you hit the crap out of the ball.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the first baseman makes a great play on it, and game's over.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, that ball gets over one more inch, and he's not making the diving play, and you win the game.
Yeah.
So it's... I guess there's something to be said about the clutch gene. I think Skip Bayless always calls it the clutch gene.
But yeah.
Look, the guys that are good enough to play in the big leagues, they're going to get there.
Right.
And the guys that aren't are going to be in the minor leagues for a long time. And guys that really aren't good aren't going to be around very long at all.
Right.
But, yeah, I just – to me – so, I mean, really it comes down to, if you know, people complain about I was better than this guy or that guy. And to me, that's just not true. If you go out there, you play hard every day, and, you know, one of Chris Crone's lines to the end of the year to the team, he felt the guys weren't giving it their all one day when we were in Bowie, and he kind of corralled him aside. He's not a yeller. I've never heard him yell at the team one time in 3 years. But when he pulls him aside, they know he's serious. And he brought up a story about how towards the end of his career, you never know who's going to be in the seats to watch you play. And there was a situation where he was in Buffalo. He had a chance to play over in Japan or Korea, and did not realize there were scouts that were in the seats that day from the team. And they came up to him afterwards and said, are you healthy? He goes, well, yeah, I'm fine. Well, why didn't you run out that ball? We thought maybe something was wrong with your leg.
Yeah.
And never got a call to go play over there. So you never know who's in the seats. And if you're good enough, they will find you. And if you do the right things, you're going to be in the big leagues.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's like that remember the DiMaggio quote about someone asked him why he played so? You know, he had chronic back problems and leg problems. And someone asked him why he played so hard when he went out. And he said, you know, maybe some kid who's never seen me play is out there today. You know,
it's true.
So I want to show him what Joe DiMaggio looks like. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I don't mean to argue about the advanced stats, but I'm curious. You know, I'm curious to learn, and I, you know, some of what I see is minor leagues are different than the big leagues. The players are different. They're different skill sets. Mm-hmm. They're different ages. Right. Most of these guys that come through are in their early 20s.
You know, you figure your college guys are 24, 25, and guys drafted out of high school is probably getting double A, 22 to 23.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're still figuring out, like, how to do their own laundry, right?
I mean, it's believe me, that's a lot of the BS that we have to put up with, too. It's
right.
No.
Where do I go live? Well, you're an adult now.
Yeah.
It's time to put your big boy. Because you figure a lot of these guys, and I'm not, you know, signaling anybody out, but, you know, look, they're professional athletes. And to get to this level, you have to be the absolute best from the college level. And to get to that level, you're the absolute best from the high school ranks. You know, it cracks me up that we'll get emails, hey, I want to try out for the Seawolves. Well, you've got no chance.
Yeah.
Because, number one, that doesn't work that way.
Right.
But, I mean, they hold open tryouts. Every major league team has open tryouts every year, and you may see one guy get signed out of the 500 that show up to that. Everybody thinks they're better than what, you know, you see on the field out here. And this is the best of, you know, obviously what the Tigers felt coming out of the college ranks when they're drafting these guys. This is who they felt was good enough to play. And this is who they feel it's good enough to play at this level. And I completely lost my train of thought of what we were going with that.
Well, I don't know. It's been a bumpy ride today.
What were we just speaking of now? I lost my train of thought.
Oh, you know, how the guys are young and
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they're young. So from a young age, if you're the best in your high school, well, you're getting everything handed to you.
Right.
If you're the best in your college, you're getting everything handed to you. Well, now you get to a different playing field, and now you're playing with the best of the best from all the colleges and all the high schools.
Yeah.
And so it's time to put on your big boy pants and find your own place to live, find your own place to do this, do that. You know, and that is
something interesting about it. Professional baseball. It's like even the worst guy on the team was the best player
absolutely
in his high school, and it's probably his whole friggin' high school league.
Absolutely,
yeah,
yeah. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, it was right. You know, in the article I wrote about the Seawolves. You know, I'd interviewed Jamie Johnson. Great, you know, nicest human being I think I've ever met in my life. Great guy. plays the game the right way. Mm-hmm. I'm using air quotes here, you know, like takes pitches, sacrifices
he's
himself
fun to watch.
For the team. He's fun to watch. He's got a you know, surprisingly good arm, mm-hmm. you know, for a little guy, 5'9", yeah. right? Probably won't be an everyday major leaguer. You know, maybe if, you know, everything bounces right for him, but the likelihood is he probably won't
ever get there.
Won't ever get there. And we dismiss those guys so easily as fans that, yeah, he never made it out of double A. But the guy is still like one of the best 500 ball players on the earth, right? Or 1,000 ball players on the
getting
earth.
Getting to double A is not a bad thing.
No, you know? Not at all.
Getting stuck at double A or triple A and never making it to the big leagues. Look, there's only 25 guys on the big league roster.
Yep.
And, you know, there's a 40-man roster. And even to get on that roster, it's tough to get on. So it's, you know, you're right. I don't think fans look at it that way enough.
Right.
And realize what they are truly seeing every time they come out to the ballpark. Because, you know, it was – and I'd like to do it at our park. We were in Harrisburg for the playoffs. I noticed a big banner they had hanging up of since their ballpark, you know, in the last 10 years – here's the players that have come through that are in the big leagues that came through with Erie and Bowie and Altoona. And the list is huge. And, you know, at our park every night, you never know. You know, Pedro Alvarez, who's now a star with the Pirates, made his double-A debut in Erie.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Andrew McCutchen played in Erie.
Yeah.
I mean, all these guys came through and Altoona came through here.
Yeah. Bryce Harper came through.
Bryce here. Harper came yeah. through. You know, and so you just never know who you're going to see. I was watching the Twins and Indians game a little bit last night, and I'm like, "Well, he was in New Britain. He was in New Britain." It's just the New Britain Twins right now at the top because they have nobody left.
Right.
But I mean, those guys all, you know, they're up in the big leagues and they were here,
yeah.
and that's something that we stress, and I don't think people appreciate it enough. And you know, you can pound it in their heads of the quality of baseball that's here, and I just don't think that. In any market, it's ever going to sink in because I think mm-hmm. people have this notion, you know.
Unless you see it on TV, it's not real.
I always hear, well, you know, you think they can make it to the pros? Well, this is the pros,
right.
Okay? This isn't amateur ball anymore. This is the pros.
Right.
It's the minor leagues. The title is the minor leagues of professional baseball.
Yeah.
And that's what it are. These are all professional baseball players. They might not be major leaguers. But
they're working their ass to get there.
They are working their asses off to get to the big league level.
Right. These are the best,
and these are the
1,000
best.
Baseball yes. players in the entire planet mm-hmm. that are playing for us. Cool. I think we should probably wrap it up.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to thank you. I mean, when I first started this podcast, I was kind of this interview was the one.
Oh, yeah.
I was fantasizing about.
Yeah,
I got to get Greg down here.
What,
to talk.
You were fantasizing about now? You've made it creepy.
No, but I'm like, I can't, counting down the days to the end of baseball.
This is short for me. I can sit here and talk for hours.
You know, we'll have you on in the spring to preview the team or
absolutely.
Something.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah absolutely. Or as you guys are maybe getting ready for some new stuff or new promotions, you got to keep us informed.
Welcome back anytime, man. Thanks a lot for coming down.
Hey, thank you guys for having me.
Sure. The slide of God, the green grass has finally grown to a set of elephants. When you're climbing up or otherwise, it will rip off your dress. The kind of car that cuts but I'm lying naked in the grass. We'll take you in the night fear and we'll wake up and sky turns black. Let me go.